that's fine.
Negro soldiers, the first lunch
where
session
the bodies
always,
are buried at.
Right, right.
Where are the Civil War bodies buried?
Right.
Please come in, have a seat.
How to identify them.
Yeah, and.
Okay, now you're official.
Good afternoon and welcome to the genealogy section. My name is Greta Bever. I'm with the Chicago Public Library. I am honored to be here with such a distinguished panel. I am an avid amateur genealogist myself, and I am as thrilled as you are to be able to listen to them today and their presentations. I am also here to remind you that if you have a Chicago Public Library card, you can use Ancestry.com at any Chicago Public Library, and you can also use Heritage Quest from your home remotely with that Chicago Public Library card. I would like to tell you about your speakers today. We're going to go in reverse order of presentation. So the person you'll be hearing in the third spot today is right next to me, Jean Lazalier Bloom. Jean is a full-time professional researcher specializing in Chicago and Cook County genealogy. Her clients are international. She also works on behalf of the Department of the Army and the Department of the Air Force and identifies family members of unaccounted for servicemen from World War II, the Korean War, and the Vietnam War. She writes articles for scholarly journals and society publications. She holds a Bachelor's of Arts in History, surprise, from the University of Illinois at Chicago, and a second year certificate in publishing from the University of Chicago's publishing program. She's a trustee and treasurer of the Board for Certification for Genealogists. Our second speaker today will be Tony Burrows, internationally known genealogist, author, lecturer, and former adjunct professor who taught genealogy at Chicago State University for 15 years. His book, Black Roots, A Beginner's Guide to Tracing the African-American Family Tree, was number one on Essence Magazine's bestseller list, and it's in its fourth printing. He's been a guest expert on CBS, PBS, the BBC, and the Discovery Channel. He has also served on the board of Gentech. And our first speaker today is with the Polish Genealogical Society. Cynthia Pike is on the board and the website committee. She has been doing Polish genealogical research for 13 years. She's also a member of the National Genealogical Society and the Association of Professional Genealogists. She's also retired from the U.S. Treasury Department, which must be a whole story all by itself. She will be your first speaker, and we will allow questions at the end. I am committed to maintaining that time, so if you have questions, jot them down, and you'll get a chance at the end. Enjoy.
Thank you, Greta, and thank you, all of you, for coming this afternoon. As she said, my name is Cynthia Pike. I'm with the Polish Genealogical Society of America. And this morning, Rebecca, in the community section, was talking about the Polish Museum of America. The Polish Museum of America hosts the Polish Genealogical Society. Essentially, we have a little office area in their library where we do our work. We're an all-volunteer organization. We have about 2,000 members nationwide and in several foreign countries. And some people think we have a staff and an office, possibly even in a building, but we are an all-volunteer organization, which I think is commendable considering how much work we're able to do. Noah has my slide presentation, and I think some of the things I'm going to be talking about you're going to be hearing echoed in other presentations. I attended the music presentation this morning, and a lot of our issues I heard from the music presentation. And genealogists both love technology for what it can do for us, and we also absolutely hate technology because of all kinds of problems and costs associated with it. That's okay. We have a technological issue here at the Chicago 2011. I'm just going to go ahead and continue while you're working on the presentation. The reason why genealogists love technology is because it really helps us communicate with other people. The PGSA goes back several years as far as being using technology for genealogists. I don't know if anyone, some younger people here, but some older people probably remember the old bulletin board systems. For you younger people, it was like Twitter, but it didn't get delivered to you. You had to go look at it. But it was essentially the same idea. You could go post information, and it was an initial sharing of information. And through the years, the PGSA has gone ahead and used every subsequent generation of genealogy to reach out to our members and to others doing Polish genealogy. So, for example, we have forum email lists. We have a website, www.pgsa.org, that has about 300 pages of information related to Polish genealogical research and databases and all sorts of information. Recently, we have a Facebook presence. Everyone has a Facebook presence, and so do we. And we found it to be actually a fun way of finding the younger generation who are really using Twitter and Facebook. They like us a lot. We've got a lot of friends, and it's been really surprising how much they've taken to Facebook. And as a nationwide organization, we use things like Skype, that type of communication technology, a lot because it really saves us a lot of money and it really facilitates communication between people. There was a time when all of our active members came from the Chicago area, and now we have several active members from across the country. And another reason we really love genealogy is because it provides us with quick and very easy accesses to sources with a lot of comprehensive knowledge on how to do genealogy, historical information. Historical society websites are important to us, and various archives, including archives in Europe, for example, the Polish archives. We can reach those through the internet now. In the old days, you had to write a letter requesting the information and put it in an envelope, put a stamp on it, and wait several months. And now we can go online to the Polish archives and see if they even have the information that we might be looking for there. And for individuals, it's relatively inexpensive. Emails are cheap, browsing the internet's inexpensive. Our libraries, like I'm in Northbrook or the Chicago Public Library, we have access to Ancestry, which can be very expensive, but you have access to Ancestry, Heritage Quests, America's death obituaries, all sorts of resources through public libraries. So for individuals now, I think it's much less expensive to do your genealogy because of technology. And we are the access to records is becoming even greater. It's actually becoming incredible. Those of you who are familiar with Ancestry know you can search and you can actually see documents. There's other paid organizations, commercial organizations like Footnote, Heritage Quest. This morning they mentioned FamilySearch.org, which is from the Latter-day Saints Family History Center. And they're doing a lot of digitalization. And the reason genealogists like FamilySearch is because it is free. And so they have, like they said, about 100,000 people who have volunteered to digitalize and to catalog the information that they're providing to us, because we appreciate the fact that they're doing this for free and making it available to anyone anywhere in the world. And as I mentioned, not only do we have access to foreign websites, but because of improvements in technology, things like Google Translate or Google Chrome, where you've got the bar across the top and they ask, do you want us to translate this page for you? Now we can easily look for websites in Eastern Europe that we wouldn't be able to read, so we would look at it and, you know, is this talking about a parish? Is it talking about a village? Is it an archive? What kind of information is here? Now we can click on, you know, would you like this translated? Please, you know, please translate it for me. At least you'll get an idea of what's on the page. Because the technology is fairly new, it doesn't always do a very good job. But at least you get the idea of what's on that page and whether it's going to be useful for you or not. Now, the reason genealogists hate technology is, we were talking about that briefly before the session started, it can easily lead to sloppy documentation of your research. I heard a story at lunchtime about students doing papers in college, and they're cutting and pasting from websites, and they don't think of giving attribution or footnoting. They don't understand that not all the information out there is necessarily correct, and even if you use it, you need to document what your source was. And a large part of good genealogy, good family history research, is documenting what your sources are so that someone can later on go back and follow up and check on that to see if that you're correct or not. And there's a lot of erroneous information out there. And those of us who are involved with genealogy at a more professional level have often met people at conferences, and you'll hear the story, well, I found this family tree and one of the names matched my family and the date was about right, so I thought it was mine, and I glommed onto that research and I spent years going in the wrong direction because that information turned out to be wrong. And that's heartbreaking because you can spend a lot of time and effort wasted if you don't think about the fact that is that information correct? Is that really my family? Is there really documentation to support what that is? Another problem is genealogists are really more like researchers or librarians rather than technologists. And speaking as a society, for us it's kind of confusing as to what kind of technology we need to use. We heard this morning about that AppTech for videos, and that was the first I had heard about that, and that's very exciting for us. But we don't really know where to look for new technology. Many genealogical societies belong to an organization called the Federation of Genealogical Societies. And what the Federation provides genealogy societies is information, papers, guidance on how to administer a society, how to run a genealogy society. But there is no similar resource for genealogy societies, histories, societies, community groups on technology. So if someone out there is an entrepreneur, you might want to think about that. It's membership based, based on the sliding scale of how many members belong to your society. But then we know we can call them up and ask them a question. We would love to know that there was a place we could go to say, well, we have this website, it's really great, but we want to add videos. What kind of software do you think we should use? Or what kind of database software should we use? So we're not technologists. We've got a very good webmaster, but he's only one person. And it would be great if there were resources available in the community for smaller organizations like ours. And I think as all of us have found, technology for anyone, but particularly a society that's trying to do larger things, can be very expensive. As I mentioned, we're an all-volunteer organization, but we find that we're going to probably have to start paying for some of the technological things that we would like to do, and it's not inexpensive. So that has been a little bit of a barrier to us expanding what we can offer to our members and also to non-members, because our website is open to the general public for the most part. And technology also needs still manual intervention. We keep hearing about things being digitalized, and that's great because I can go online and click a button and I can see a marriage certificate or a death certificate and I can save it or I can print it out. But we think that it looks so easy because all we did was push a button. And we don't think about what went behind it to get that digitalization accomplished and put online for us. And we have learned, for example, the Family History Center has digitalized a lot of the Polish Museum records, and we have thousands of files of digitalized documents, basically pictures. And the way they are named is simply by a number. So to make each of those thousands of files useful, we need a project, and we need lots of volunteers to go in, open each file, look at the picture, see whose document that was, a name or what it is, and then close it, and then rename it, And then when that's done, then we have to create a database from all of that. There are tens of thousands of digitalized pictures, and we're trying to figure out how are we gonna do this? We just don't have that many people to accomplish that. And these are important records. Some of them are cards from Polish detainees in Austrian concentration camps after World War II. There are people looking for their families. And if we could get this information online, they might be able to find them. So it's really important, but it's there's got to be a lot of manual intervention with it. So we have a lot of volunteers and organizations, but we could always use more. Another problem is that a genealogy society or a history society is it's like a small business, and so we don't have the sophisticated technological knowledge that a regular business might have. We don't file tax returns, and so we can't deduct the expense. It comes right out of our membership fees. And then we have such a broad range of members. In an office setting, you're working with people from their 20s to their 60s. We're working with people from their 20s into their 80s, and I'll bet we probably even have a few members that are in their 90s. We have to serve all of them. We have to help all of them. So while the young people want Facebook and databases and websites and electronic magazines, our older members still want us to have meetings, still want us to have conferences and mail them the journal 4 times a year so that they can sit down and read it. And so again, it would be great if there was some way where we could have a community resource, a university available to help us and guide us and to give us some ideas of what we can do to bring more technology into our organization to make it easier for other people. If you want to find out more about the PGSA, or if you want to help us, the next slide has our website, and I invite you to go take a look at it, because people have told us that they're very impressed with our website and surprised that we're all volunteers. And you can contact us, that's our email address, or we are on Facebook. And frankly, right now, we are looking for help with our databases, to organize them better, have them run better, and we're also looking for help with just basic updating of our website. So if you're interested in Polish genealogy, please contact us. If you've got any questions, we'll talk to you later then. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Cynthia. Our next speaker is Tony Burrows. I neglected part of my job as chair, which was to ask you all to turn your cell phones off or on vibrate. I just remembered mine. So if you could take a moment to do that, that would be great.
Good afternoon. It's funny, she said that everybody should turn their cell phones off or turn them on to vibrate. I was at a conference once and a lady got up and said, would everybody turn their vibrators on? Kind of blew that just a little bit. I'm going to talk about how technology has changed the work of genealogists, kind of like the past, the present, and the future. I've been doing genealogy since 1975. It's like 36 years ago. Back then, the world was very, very different. Computers weren't around, which is hard to believe. The internet wasn't around, cell phones, digital cameras. Very few businesses and libraries had even Xerox machines. So it was a very, very different world. Back then, you almost had to always visit a library or an archive to get some research done. You had to take notes on paper. In fact, I saved all my old notes. Some of them were on pencil, and it's kind of like smudged, you know, but still great information. It's very time-consuming just to get to a library, then very time-consuming to use the library. I remember when, you know, we were first going off, the first thing you had to do when you got to a library archives is you had to go through the card catalog to see what was in the collection before you decided what you were going to look at, and oftentimes that would take anywhere from a half hour to 3 hours just to go through the card catalog and determine what you wanted to look at. If you wanted to get a death certificate, you had to, if you were living in a place that was different from where your ancestors lived, you had to mail for a death certificate, and it might take anywhere from, you know, 2 to 5 or 6 weeks to get a death certificate back. I did a lot of research at the National Archives. There's a National Archives in Chicago on 74th and Pulaski. That's where they had, well, I was going to say that's where they had all the census records. But back when I started, they didn't even have all the census records. They had most of the census records, and the ones they didn't have were at the Center for Research and Libraries on over at the University of Chicago. So that was about a 45-minute drive to get to the archives. Then you had to look through the indexes and then use the indexes and look through the records. So it might take you anywhere from 2 to 5 hours, you know, for one trip to go and just look at census records. Now, things are very, very differently. As a genealogist and as well as a consultant, most libraries and archives have their catalogs online, so you don't have to leave your house. You can just go online, look through the card catalogs, as well as you can search by author, title, subject, as well as keyword searches. You know, back in the libraries, they had an author, title, subject, but they didn't have a keyword search, so it's a lot of different searches you can do now. A lot of the libraries and archives have even a lot of data online. They're taking a lot of their books, digitizing their books, taking their indexes. A lot of libraries that have, say, indexes to obituaries in a newspaper, a lot of those are online. So you can look at the indexes online, as well as sometimes even have the obituaries online. For vital records now, that's a very different life too. Instead of writing off, you know, to another state, you can go online, and some places have the indexes to their vital records online. Once you find a name on the index, then you can hit another key, put in your credit card, and you can print out the birth certificate, death certificate, or marriage license right there, you know, and do all that in like 5 minutes, which used to take, you know, like about 5 weeks. Ancestry.com, as well as everybody knows, has all the census records online. Again, when I used to have to drive over to the archives and do a census search, I was anywhere from 2 to 5 hours. Now you can go online to Ancestry and do that in like 5 minutes. You know, it's just really, really incredible. And in fact, a lot of the early research that I've done, where I had to drive over to the archives and make a printout, even the first printouts on those microfilm machines were water-based printout, and those things got smudged and are all messed up. So now it takes me 5 minutes to duplicate all that research. So, and not only when you duplicate it online, but you can save the images online and not only have them on your hard drive at home, but I dump them to my notebook, and as I travel around the country, I have those on my notebook. Now you can dump them to an iPhone, you can dump them to an iPad, and so you have all this just gigabytes of information you can just carry around with you that before was unbearable. And in fact, when I first got started doing genealogy, I researched constantly for about 2 years. I had boxes and boxes of data, and I couldn't find stuff I had like collected, you know, because again, there were no computers, so trying to find something you had put together was really very, very challenging, whereas now, you know, you can create your own indexes for a lot of that stuff. Now things like having a website is mandatory. Mandatory if you're a consultant, if you're a professional, you want to advertise your services, you have to have a website. A lot of genealogists are having family websites so that other people that are researching their lines can see data, you know, on their website. Also used for families connecting with their other families living across the country. A lot of people have using Facebook. In fact, it was interesting from the last presentation that someone mentioned that people are using only Facebook and nothing else, you know, which is interesting. I always talk about people using nothing but Google and thinking Google is research, and now people are using Facebook and thinking that is just the internet, you know. There's things now like findagrave.com where a lot of people are doing indexes of graveyards and uploading the indexes online as well as the images. I was online last week and what was I looking for? I can't even remember what I was looking for, but all of a sudden, I typed in the name Burroughs and I found a photograph of my brother's grave marker, you know, that I didn't even know was online, you know. He's buried in the National Cemetery out in Abraham Lincoln National Cemetery. And so I knew that they had a listing for my great-grandfather who was a Buffalo soldier, and he's buried in the National Cemetery, so I went online to find the grave, and sure enough, there he is listed on Find a Grave, and they have a photograph of the entrance to the cemetery. So I just took time and I have a image of his grave marker, so I just uploaded it right to findagrave.com, as well as I put in his service information, so anybody's looking for that, they not only see his grave marker, but also his service information and his dates of birth and death. So all that is just really opens up tremendous doors, not only for people searching, but people that have their own information from their families, they can upload on there. Digital audio now is very ubiquitous. When I do interviews, I always use a digital tape recorder, or I say a digital voice recorder. So you interview someone, as soon as you finish your interview, you connect it to your computer, and it's on your computer, you can email it, you can play it back. I put it on my iPhone. I was in Washington, D.C., and I met a new relative who I'd known, his sister and his father and his grandfather. And so it just so happened that I had an interview I did with his grandfather, and I played it for him, and like tears came down through his eyes because he was a little kid when his grandfather died. So he doesn't know a lot about his grandfather, and his grandfather, who I'd interviewed back in 1977, is talking about growing up in Western Pennsylvania and everything that he did growing up on his farm. So it was really amazing. Plus, when I do my lectures, I record my lectures digitally, so I have all those preserved and have them, you know, on my hard drive. Digital video. When I do many interviews, sometimes I use a digital video camera. So not only is it recorded digitally, I can dump it down to my computer, I can do editing, I can add things on, take things off. Also, we're into what we call family history videos, where we can do our own documentary videos now on the family history. So all the research that you've collected, you can dump that on the computer and use a video editing program to make it like Ken Burns. You know, even if you don't have any video, you can take your documents and your artifacts and make them move on the screen and whatever. Digital cameras we use every day, use them to not only shoot relatives, but also documents. You can go to a library and sometimes, or an archives, if they don't let you use a scanner, they'll allow you to bring in a digital camera. So you can take images of documents. We take images of artifacts. Also, when we go out on location, take digital images of grave markers, of churches our ancestors went to, schools, homes, all kinds of things. You can also use digital software to repair old photographs, take out blemishes. You can add parts on, take parts off, add people on, take people off. People are also using creating digital scrapbooks, where you can use photographs and documents and whatever, making a scrapbook of all your research. You can use MP3 files now. When I do a digital interview, I've got that interview on an MP3 file. I take that MP3 file and I email it to a company in Boston who does transcriptions. And they can do a transcription in a couple days and email me back a Microsoft Word file of that entire interview that I did, just in a couple of days. Again, none of that was available a few years ago. Digital mapping and land platting. What I do is I collect land deeds of places where my ancestors lived or where the slave owners lived, and take a description of that land deed, use software, and it plats it out into a graphic, and you can put two and three together and just totally recreate the neighborhoods. You can use Google Earth, and you can put pins in all the places where your ancestors lived, as well as photographs, as well as the outlines of the deeds. Use iPhones and iPads a lot. Not only in talking to people in distant areas, but also storing data, storing photographs, interviews, also charts, and as well as conducting research. There's one, Cynthia and a lady earlier had mentioned FamilySearch.org, which is the Mormons branch of the genealogy branch of the Mormon Family History Center. They have a site where you could take an application for an iPhone and you can go to their site and search their website as well as download images, but I just read a couple weeks ago they're taking that down or discontinuing it, but I think they're probably gonna come out with some new app in another year or so. Webinars, electronic seminars on the web are very popular, not only for teaching but also learning about genealogy. There's a lot of sites that are doing that. Ancestry.com now, you not only can search for your family, but also you can connect with other relatives that are researching your family. So that's kind of like what's happening in the present. In the future, they asked me to make some predictions. I'm not good at predicting. When I was working on my book, I had in there that there was a few census images that are online, but the National Archives did not have the resources to digitize all the census records, so they would never be online. Little did I know the private industry would come along and offshore a lot of this stuff, and within a couple years, all that data came online. So I'm not making any predictions, but I can kind of tell you where some of the things are moving. FamilySearch.org, again, the Family History Library in Salt Lake City has 2.5 million reels of microfilm of genealogy information all over the world. Births, deaths, marriages, christenings, real estate, wills, probates, all kinds of stuff. They're in the process right now of digitizing every one of those 2.5 million reels of microfilm and uploading that for free. So that's gonna totally change, you know, like how we do genealogy. There's a lot of colleges and universities that are digitizing stuff every day and uploading online. Some of you may know that are doing African-American genealogy about the ex-slave narratives, about interviews that were done with former slaves. The largest collection was with the WPA, and they have about 2,500 narratives, but few people are aware of the narratives they did before the WPA. The WPA was the late 1930s and 40s, but there were many narratives done before then. University of North Carolina is uploading about 5,000 of those interviews on their website. There's a lot of local projects. Google Books is trying to do a lot of things online. There's a lot of trend towards social networking, where people that are all doing genealogy are doing their genealogy online, connecting with other people. Cloud computing, where people are storing data online. And lastly, I want to mention a couple of the challenges in the future. That even though a lot of people are doing genealogy, doing a lot of it online, a lot of them don't know fundamental genealogy. And if you don't know fundamental genealogy, then doing stuff online is not going to take you real far. Also, people need to know about how to evaluate other people's research, because if you're relying on someone else's research, you need to know how to evaluate that. It's a challenge keeping pace with technological change, because it changes every year. Understanding these new technologies, a lot of people don't even understand current technologies, let alone future technologies. Understanding the limitations of these technologies is very challenging. And lastly, but not least, not neglecting those non-technological resources. As I tell people oftentimes, it's not all on the web, and you need to understand what's on the web and what's not on the web. Thank you very much and good luck.
Final speaker today on the panel will be Jean Leslier Bloom, and we'll have questions at the end. So I know you all are anxious to ask questions. There will be time.
It's interesting that as I was leaving the house this morning, the last email message that I received was an invitation through LinkedIn to join the Ohio Genealogical Group. This is how genealogy is and technology, social networking. Yesterday I received a notice that the Southern California Jamboree has an iPhone app. I'm constantly being bombarded by technology and technological change. The reason that I was invited was because of my association with the Chicago Genealogical Society. And the Chicago Genealogical Society is a dinosaur. It is a very, very slow adapter of technology. And it's not necessarily because there isn't an awareness of what technology is available. It has to do with the structure of the organization. You have volunteers, and most of these volunteers that are serving in officer positions are of the pre-technological age. And yeah, dinosaurs. I hear someone saying dinosaurs. I wasn't going to use the term dinosaurs, but dinosaurs. And you also have people that are very protective of their turf. Mm-hmm. And once they've decided that they are the technological Maven or whatever, they don't want anyone else intruding on that technology. And they will take care of it. And even if the society says, we'll hire a consultant, we'll put resources, I'll get to it. So when you're dealing with a volunteer society, it isn't an ideal world as far as adopting the technology. With the Chicago Genealogical Society, what we have is a website, and we have an email address. And that's about it. We've got one page on the website that is a link to all sorts of URLs for resources or other sites in Cook County and outside of Cook County. The society uses it to post its calendar. It uses it to promote its ancestor certificate program. The information is rarely updated. The content isn't very current. There are a couple of databases out there. There's no links with online images. The organization does not have any type of social networking presence. There's nothing, no Facebook, there's no email list. Cloud computing is not something that's on their radar. The society is very fortunate in that it's located in Chicago. It has a captive market as far as people that have traveled through Chicago and that have ancestors or some type of relationship with the Chicago area. So it has a strong membership base. I don't see it continuing unless they begin to adapt and adopt new technology. But with the current personalities and what goes on in the society, I don't see that happening, at least anytime soon until people die off or something. With that said, and this being a technologically oriented conference, what I would rather talk about is myself as a researcher, what I do, what I see, what I value out there in the world. I research 7 days a week, and I'm usually on the computer or at a repository or something, probably an average of 8 to 10 hours a day. I mean, this is my life. I don't have much of a life outside. Luckily, it's my passion. So friends, activities. I made a New Year's resolution that this year I would try to remember to have dinner and go out with friends. and I'm doing pretty good. But I really had to pull myself back. The gold standard in what I expect as a researcher now is online images. I want to see the image. I expect for it to be there. And I think FamilySearch, as Tony was talking about, has set the standard for that. You not only want to go in and have the indexing, you want to, once you found something of interest in the indexing, you want to go to the image and see what it is. I'm seeing a lot more of that, not just with FamilySearch, but for instance, the state of Missouri has their vital records up until the mid-1950s, where I can go in on a county and I can have a surname, and maybe I don't know who they're related to or whatever. I can just start going through every one of the death certificates, looking to see if there's a relationship to the family of interest. In Chicago, the Cook County Clerk's Office has their vital records online, genealogy online. One of my wishes as a researcher is that they had worked with genealogists when they designed the site. Because you can go in as far as the index, and if your person is John Smith and you know that they've died between 1950 and 1955, you still may have 150 death certificates and you don't know who your person is. They didn't put in enough information to really be able to tell. It's wonderful to have it up there. It's wonderful, once you've honed in, to be able to download the death certificate or birth certificate or marriage record right away and have it in hand. But it's useless if it's a common name and you don't know a specific date. So a technique that you'll use, and like with the Chicago Public Library, I love the Chicago Public Library. I love having 24-hour access to the historic Chicago Tribune. Because I can go in there and put my search terms in and narrow down and find things, and I can use techniques like using addresses to try and find out more about families or getting clues. There are problems with the historic Chicago Tribune as far as the searches and what's in there. Some obituaries and death notices for some years are there. Some aren't included. There's nothing. One of the suggestions, for instance, if you're a researcher and you're not like me where you have used it over and over and over again and are aware of its limitations, if you have someone from outside the region that goes in there to use that database or to look at those online images, they will think that their person's death notice is not published in the Tribune because it doesn't show up when they're doing that surname and date type search. And this goes to what Tony says. Just because I haven't found it in the Tribune or in an index or an online doesn't mean that it's not there. And this is where now the next step is I have to get up, go away from my computer, go down to the Harold Washington Library and go through each issue, you know, for a week after whatever the date of death is, seeing if the item was published there. I'm just extremely lucky if there was an obituary or a death notice published. The clerk of the courts of Cook County has done a project, and the Polish Genealogical Society was really active with this, as far as declarations of naturalizations, of transcribing and creating a database for those. The Newberry, when I walked in here, had the Chicago Ancestors website that they have up, which is not only linked to addresses and where you can find resources and information based on addresses, but they've got a fabulous resource page if you go in there on the tabs and look. The Chicago Genealogical Society, as I mentioned, doesn't have a Facebook presence, but genealogical societies, I have this theory that many, many genealogical societies were formed on the basis of friendship and on face-to-face networking originally. So genealogists have taken up Facebook big time. I mean, they like being chatty and chatting back and forth with one another. So it is a huge place for genealogists. You'll find lots of genealogists on Facebook. You'll find a much slower transition to LinkedIn. I see them pop up on Facebook and be out there for 6 months, year, 2 years, and then all of a sudden there's a slow transition over to LinkedIn. It's a different culture, and that cultural background and attitude of the real world is reflected, I think, in the virtual world. As Tony mentioned, one of the pitfalls of the online electronic world are pitfalls that we've had traditionally in the hard copy, social, face-to-face world. One of the things has to do with these online family trees, and I love online family trees. When I'm working with my soldier and Air Force cases, I love people that have put up their trees, and I've got a place to begin. I've got a structure to either prove or disprove. But I know enough that I don't take them as gospel, and they are clues for future research. As a professional researcher, I love people that go out and glom onto the easiest family there is, and that's their ancestors, because I end up with those people as my clients who say, I've reached a problem here. Something isn't quite working. And you can pay me to sort out that problem for you, and I'm more than willing to do it. And I mean, I probably have one of those clients a month that it's like, okay, I've got back to 1850 in Missouri, and and if I can solve this 1850 in Missouri problem, I'm all the way back to 1600s in England. And we go back to the 1850, and they have grafted on a family that was easy, had the same name somebody had done, but it hadn't been based upon real records, real information, and then we have to get it all unsorted. We also find that Everybody now believes that it is easy to do genealogy. It's all out there on the web. It's out there on the internet. Anybody and everybody can do that. And it's a problem as far as consumers, because people that don't have and haven't worked to acquire the appropriate skill set are calling themselves professional genealogists. So it is really becoming a buyer beware world where the consumer needs to check out. And to show you how popular genealogy is becoming, you're now finding fraud in genealogy. I mean, there's, you always had, when there was a hard copy world, these, you can have a coat of arms, let us, you know, and it was all phone book directory type things. Well, the same thing is occurring now, but it's associated with celebrities. I will provide you with your celebrity genealogy. Person has no background, but they're going to get paid and they're going to get money for this. So I think that as far as consumer awareness and education, if that doesn't occur, a lot of people are going to be taken advantage of. Tony mentioned that all professional genealogists should have websites. I don't have a website. And it's a business decision of why I don't have a website. I don't have the patience to be an educator on a one-to-one basis with clients, of taking them through, okay, this is step one, I want my clients and generally to have some sort of sophistication to be able to find me. And for them to do that, if I don't have a website, they need to know that, oh, there's an association for professional genealogists, there's a board for certification of genealogists, there's a Newberry Library researchers list or a Chicago History Museum. So I intentionally, to discourage people that don't have a certain set of a certain sophistication from contacting me, don't have a web presence. Where I see things going, I use cloud computing now. I mean, I have become a big advocate of cloud computing because I can share with my colleagues that also work on these soldier and Air Force cases, where we can share websites that we found, information. We had a number of Philippine cases, and none of us were experienced Philippine researchers, and we were trying to dig out, how do you do Philippine research, where are the records, what type of information, and instead of each one of us having to go through that, we could put everything up in the cloud as we found it. And then whenever anybody needed the information, it was there for them to grab. As opposed to attaching an attachment to an email and sending it, it just had a permanent presence there. So that then when we were at the Family History Library, we had our film numbers and everybody could use it as a source. We're seeing a huge explosion of genealogists that Twitter, blog, I mean, there are so many genealogy blogs. If I read every genealogy blog that has come out in the last year, year and a half, I would not have a business. I would be spending all my time. There's going to be a shakeout of those that are good blogs and those that aren't good blogs. Where do I see libraries? I love libraries that have at least indexes for obituaries, you know. Online. If not, I'm going to be, hopefully you have an email address, I'm going to email you and say, I would like for you to search for this obituary, and I want, I love it when they can send me scanned copies back, but I will wait for a hard copy. With libraries, I go through the whole gamut. I mean, it's from where I have to write a letter with a stamp, with a, you know, self-addressed stamped envelope to return asking for an obituary, to those where it's indexed, I can tell them exactly where they need to go, you know, send them my email, and they have it back to me within the week. Wish there were more of those. Of course, then I want to see the images linked, you know, that's the next step. But, you know, I'll dream big. Librarians are the access point in many, many cases for genealogists, for the initial genealogist. That's who they go to, who someone that has watched a Who Do You Think You Are or watched a Gates program says, I'm gonna do this, and the next day they're in the libraries. So most libraries I see now are having genealogists or someone that they designate as their genealogist or local history person. And so that's basically kind of a thumbnail in, you know, 10 to 15 minutes where I'm at as far as technology and where the society that I belong to here in the area, the Chicago Genealogical Society, there's a huge disconnect between my society and myself. And with that, I'll turn it and we can go to questions.
If any of you have questions for a specific panelist or for the panel as a whole, this would be the time. We've got one here. We have a microphone so that we can get you recorded for posterity.
You may not want to record me. Questions denote a kind of paranoia. Number one, I've always, not lately, but understood genealogy to be a hobby of the people who would like to be elite, the DAR, the WASP, the people who came on the Mayflower, the people who want to distinguish themselves from others. Now, obviously it's changed, but I don't know how long ago it's changed. So that's one question. And then my other one, another paranoid question, is I've heard that the familyhistory.com site from the Church of the Latter-day Saints does some converting of us after we're dead, so please clarify what those are.
Yeah, we were actually talking about, because the PGSA has been around since 1978, and you'll find a lot of genealogy societies were started about the mid-70s. And I think it's rightly attributed to two things, the 1976 bicentennial of the United States, and it got people thinking about the history of the United States. And actually, I think actually more important was the miniseries Roots, because people who were, for example, of European descent said, well, gosh, look how he's been able to find all the way back to Africa, and there should be records for Europe also. And a lot of the societies were started about that time. Long ago, probably before Roots and before the PGSA and other more ethnic societies, you probably did find, in fact, those who thought they were related to nobles. I mean, Poland had nobility, and the people who were looking for their ancestry were looking to see whether I was related to a noble or a king or something like that. I can tell you right now that probably 99% of our members come from farms. And so we're just regular people who have interesting family histories. And as far as the Latter-day Saints, all of us have, you can't do research without working at a family history library, family history center, or their website. And while on their website there are links where you can go and learn about the Mormon Church, I have never been approached in all the probably hundreds of times I've been in a library or a center by anyone evangelizing. So their history centers and their library are strictly there for genealogical research. For them it is religious related, but they don't proselytize or evangelize when you're doing research.
Is this mic on?
Yes, it is.
Okay. What you said, Cynthia, is true, but what you said is also true. They do take the research that they've done and perform some kind of church ceremonies on them. And when the Jewish community found this out, they complained to them. And so they got them to stop doing that with Jewish families. And exactly the extent of it, I really don't know, but they do. I think it's some part of their religion where they want to baptize people posthumously, you know. Right, and I don't know the extent of what they do with that, and I also don't know what the extent they talk about that, you know, because as you know, they don't talk about everything that they do, you know, in their church or whatever.
And as far as your questioner's statement about, you know, the DAR and all of that type of thing. One of the things that I think might be affecting that is families and extended families used to be in communities, and now people are spread all over the United States, and they've lost in many cases the oral histories, you know, where they would be at the kitchen table with their grandmother, or they'd hear their aunts and uncles talking. And I sense, I mean, that especially among younger people, that there's a real hunger to learn about the family that probably was learned in other times by sitting around and was learned orally, and now they don't have that kind of opportunity, so they have to do it through papers and through doing genealogy.
In the back there?
There's a popular notion that older people are the ones who get interested in genealogy. I must confess I'm in the case of that myself. However, it seems to me an interesting question would be to what extent genealogists are working in elementary and secondary schools. We once tried a project to get the school system to ask all the seniors, the graduating seniors, to do a project on their own family history as a way of popularizing and democratizing the whole process. Because what we discovered is that you ask somebody the question, if somebody did something to one of your relatives, what would you do? And they have a whole conversation about that. And then, of course, you say, well, look at what's happening across the street from you or in your own neighborhood. And if everybody in a high school of a small community did genealogical research, they might find out that we're all sort of related.
Personally, I've done quite a bit of work with schools. I was under contract with Ancestry.com, and I was able to get Chicago Public Schools and New York Public Schools free access to Ancestry.com, as well as gave them copies of Family Tree Maker. And so they were able to use that inside the classroom. I was also consulting with the Chicago Public Schools, and Chicago Public Schools developed a genealogy curriculum based on Henry Louis Gates's book on Oprah's genealogy that conformed to Illinois learning standards. They started that on their own as a genealogy committee. They brought me in as a consultant to help follow genealogy guidelines. And so that was sent out to all the middle schools and high schools in Chicago. Then with Ancestry, we also gave them FamilyTreeMaker, you know, .com, so they could not only learn history that's connected to their family, as well as other areas, because it's an interdisciplinary curriculum, because genealogy touches every facet of life. And that was very, very popular in several of the schools. I also worked directly with Finger High School, where Darian Albert got beat to death, you know, with a 2x4 that was on video. And we did genealogy workshops twice a week out of Finger. And we had them build a wall. It's an art wall in the lunchroom in Finger High School. And many kids brought in photographs of their ancestors, documents of their ancestors. They put them permanently on the wall, as well as I had the students interview each other about their life stories. We interviewed at least one parent about her life story, and each kid got a CD-ROM of those interviews. Just recently, I was in South Carolina, and I spoke to 5 elementary schools down there and gave them genealogy workshops. With some of the PBS programs that came out on genealogy, particularly the Ancestors programs that came out in 97 and 2000, they had genealogy curriculums online, where schools could use those genealogy curriculums to teach genealogy in the classroom that, again, based on learning standards, so they could apply them to history, to math, to social studies, geography, and all that. So there's a ton of stuff on the web for schools who want to use genealogy. So there's a lot of stuff going on. And we found out that kids, if you bring the subject to them, they're fascinated by it. So all you have to do is expose them.
Don't the Scouts, the Boy Scouts?
Yes.
Boy Scouts, I read every now and then, have badges that
yes,
they can earn in genealogy by working on a certain project.
I actually got started in 1975 with the Boy Scout merit badge book for genealogy, and they've been doing it ever since. And also the Girl Scouts don't have a genealogy badge, but they have kind of like a local history badge, you know. So they're doing similar kinds of things for genealogy with the Girl Scouts.
I got to tell you, I was astounded this week. I was, I guess it must have been after the news or during the news, but anyway, I was doing channel flipping, which I want to do. And I realized that this episode of The Simpsons was about genealogy, and it had to do with a genealogy project for school. And I was amazed that, I mean, it was actually taking them through the right steps in a Simpson program, you know, start at home, interview, go up into the attic, and she finds a diary, and then there's not enough information, and she ends up at the library. And I thought, to me, it was an insight that not only is the desire there, but there's got to be an interest, you know, in kids, and that this whole episode would be about genealogy and how you do research and how you come out. But the thing that really got me was at the end, the grandfather is sitting there, and she doesn't have the end of her genealogy journey as to what happened, you know, at the end of the story. And he says, oh, well, I know that. And that's exactly what happened to me with my mother. My mother was like, well, I don't know anything about genealogy. I don't know anything about the family. And I had spent, you know, like a year or so, and I finally figured out that her German Catholic family from Kansas did not immigrate from Germany to Kansas, that they had come in through Ohio and the Cincinnati region. And my mother, who didn't know anything, said, oh yeah, well, that was the aunt that used to come and sleep on the sofa. And so it was like, oh yes, they have really captured perfectly in this Simpson episode. But when you ask about older people, I think as far as having the luxury of time, when you don't have the pressing, you know, of earning a living, of raising kids, of all of the other, and you've got the time, that's why it skews to older people. But I think that the computer is changing that now you have younger people that at any time when they can catch a bit of time during the day or night, the kids are in bed, you know, that half hour or hour, they're going online and doing genealogy. Whereas before, it would have been more, I've got to, you know, take the day off, I've got to go down to the Newbury, I've got to go to the Chicago Public Library. So I think it's more demands on people's time and convenience rather than an interest.
Anyone else?
My question is, you talked a lot about using volunteers to help with your organization. And what I'm most concerned about is the digitization, right? And so what I'd like to know are what are your policies, procedures, or trainings, if there are any, with volunteers with the digitization process? Because, you know, as you know, like less than 10 years ago, you know, we've seen that some things have been done incorrectly, and it's, you know, it's happened so that it has cost organizations a lot more money to correct those things. And just to give you a little bit of background, like right now I'm working on a project, and the organization that was looking for, you know, people to employ for this particular project just wanted some folks to do like data entry. And fortunately for myself and another person on the team, you know, we have a bit of library background. We're both in GISLIS, we're leaders, you know, and we thought it was more important to have people who, you know, really have like a passion for this and an understanding of what this information is going to look like in the end and how it can be accessible to people, say like 15, 20 years from now. So I'm just wondering, like, what are your procedures in place that, you know, you have with your volunteers?
Well, I think anyone who has used the Ellis Island Foundation website understands what you're talking about, because while they had a lot of volunteers who were very sincere about what they were doing as far as indexing the ship's immigration lists, that so many mistakes were made that people have a hard time often finding their family. They know they came in through Ellis Island, but it was done so poorly that it's a problem. The databases that we have right now on our website were all done by volunteers, but they were not done from digitalized records. They were actually done from microfilm records. And what we would like to do is now we actually have digitalized records, and we have not yet started to name them or index them. So frankly, we're at the point where we need to develop procedures to make sure that it's done correctly, that it's done consistently, that it's done with enough information so that if and when we put it on our website, we don't have the problem where you search for the name and there's 20 records and which one is your family. Because I know we're Polish, but there's a lot of Kowalskis out there. So, I mean, we have the same problem. So we are at that point where we've done this before with microfilms, and now we need to do it with digitalization. And we need to write the procedures. So if you want to volunteer,
I'll check everything.
Okay.
with your data that you're working with, is it typed data or images, or is it handwritten data? Yeah. What I had was thinking about before you came up with that, when these companies were working with census data was handwritten data. So you could have a lot of mistakes on interpreting the handwriting. And one of the training procedures and checks and balances they use were two people entering the same data. And then when they didn't get the same result, then a third person who was more experienced would look over that to make the decision on what was correct. The only problem you run in with that is you can have two people make the exact same mistake, and then it wouldn't like kick out. But you're not dealing with handwritten data, so that's not one of the...
Well, actually, on some of the disks and the J-cards, they are handwritten.
Okay.
But the funny thing about it now is because we have the advantage of technology, some of us can go, well, what was that again? I don't know. Let me see it. I'll Google it. Mm-hmm. And then we look it up and we see what it actually is. Whereas, before you had to use two and three people. And the sad thing about that is that now organizations don't have the resources mm-hmm. to pay those people. And as well as you may not have that many volunteers if it's a matter of money and pay to do that.
Yeah.
So we do sometimes run into that.
Sure.
And this is so loosely related. I took an XML workshop. And what's really interesting about that, like the metadata, the data for the data, with interpreting like handwritten information, there's some programs now that can read them and interpret them with that. But so far as our organization, yes, some of it is typed and some of it is handwritten. But we just double check by using the internet as a resource.
Yeah.
Or if we can interrupt someone who is still at the station who worked on that particular.
I think this goes right back to we love technology, we hate technology. So if you would like to join me in thanking our panel, I found it a very fascinating hour.
Wanted to suggest that coming late to the party for Chicago society may benefit that being able to leapfrog any of the mistakes, some of the earlier technologies.
You've given me such an optimistic way to look at it. I'm going to hang on to that.
Right, because early adopters run a risk of,
that's true.
The trial and error and all of
that.
That's true.
And
that's true.
So now you'll have much better models to choose from,
mm-hmm. yeah,
software
yeah.
and all of that.
Well,
and you, let's make an app and get rich.
Oh, absolutely.
That's why I heard the no, come on, Tony, let's make an app.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, nice to meet you too.
The best way to spend the afternoon.
You know,
thank you.
Take care.
Hey, let me, you got a quick minute?
Mm-hmm.
Check out my latest project.
Okay.
I'm researching a
I would start, first I want to get the death certificate, so that I know specifically, you know, the hospital, the date of death, you know, so that I have that type of information. World War II, death during that time, the Veterans Administration is the agency that would have, he would have been under for that hospitalization. It's probably a file that is no longer an active file for the Veterans Administration. The National Archives and Records Administration has those closed Veterans Affairs files. If National Archives and Records Administration, you'll see it referred to as NARA. I believe that those have been sent to St. Louis, but I'm not positive. But you could call here the National Archives and Records Administration, Chicago branch, and they can point you in the right direction. One of the things that will be very helpful to have is the serial number. If you got his army service, because everything's going to be on personnel and record center in St. Louis. There was a fire in the 70s, and most of the records for the army. They can recreate and put together a file, but it's not the original record. The application, now that your husband's next of kin, there's an electronic application online where you can order the
PowerPoint.
If you do like a Google search for military records.
Okay.
I'm going to take a couple days to respond. But go ahead, ma'am.